In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast. Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. In the early 19th century, two different British expeditions headed into the interior of West Africa, and both ended in disaster. In today's episode, we'll be hearing about what exactly went wrong on those expeditions from Dane Kennedy, Emeritus Professor of History and the author of Mungo Park's Ghost, The Haunted Hubris of British Explorers in 19th Century Africa. He was speaking with Eleanor Evans.
We're talking today about a book which explores two ambitious and disastrous British expeditions to West Africa in the early 19th century. We'll get into why they happened and more about them in due course. But as the title of your book, Mungo Park's Ghost, alludes to, Dane, these expeditions came in the wake of another explorer. Can we start with Mungo Park himself? Who was he and what was he up to in the early 19th century?
Yeah, Mungo Park was a Scottish physician who became explorer and really came to fame for an expedition he made into West Africa in the 1790s. It was, in some respects, not much of an expedition. That is to say, he didn't discover anything particularly earth-shattering or new, but he survived 2 years in West Africa, often under very difficult circumstances, and managed to come back to Britain, and as a result, became really a romantic hero in Britain. Poems were written about him. He was feted by the British aristocracy. He was the object of enormous attention. He wrote an account of his expedition that became a bestseller. And as a result, you know, found himself in a situation where he wasn't quite sure what he was going to do afterwards, and was persuaded in 1805 to return to West Africa, this time leading a force of 50 men with the intention of reaching the headwaters of the Niger River and following the Niger to its outlet, which was unknown to Europeans at that time. It was on that expedition that he disappeared and, as we now know, died, which only enhanced his reputation as an explorer, an adventurer, a romantic hero.
That's a great sense of Park as a figure. I wonder if we can dive into a little bit more this final demise, what was known about it at the time, how it got portrayed in Britain, and then what's come to be known about it since, because that's important for what comes next, isn't it?
Absolutely. So for about 5 years, the British had no idea what had happened to him. And eventually they commissioned an African who had been the guide who had led him to the headwaters of the Niger, who was a trader in West Africa, to figure out what had taken place. And so this individual made the journey back to the Niger River. He interviewed various people. He eventually managed to come in contact with another African who had served as his guide when he went down much of the river, and wrote a report in Arabic, which was sent back to British authorities and translated, which is a fascinating document that really details what took place. Basically, Mungo Park, by the time he reached the Niger River, most of his men were dead. He had about 4 or 5 men left. He purchased a couple of slaves to help him on his journey. They cobbled together a vessel. They armed it with as many arms as they could, plus supplies, and they started down the river. And by this point, it was clear that Mungo Park had become pretty paranoid, as well as extremely ill, as were the other members of his party. And so whenever any Africans on the river began to approach his vessel, they fired on them. And they killed countless people. This had a lasting impact on the views of Africans in this region towards European explorers, and it in fact led to the subsequent death of at least one other explorer on a journey in the territory. So the account tells us that Mungo Park and what was left of his crew made their way most of the way down the river, where they were confronted by a group of Africans who had heard reports from above about his behavior. From the shore, they assaulted the vessel. The vessel was going through a narrow strait at this point, or rapids, and everyone perished. Mungo Park evidently jumped overboard to escape the arrows and missiles, as did the other members of the crew, and they drowned, apart from one African who subsequently reported what had happened to others. So that's the story of Mungo Park, a pretty appalling story, but it wasn't the story that the British public wanted to hear, and it really wasn't the story that they did hear. So even though this report was reported back to England and to British authorities, it wasn't widely disseminated, and there was a general view that it couldn't be believed because it was in fact coming from Africans. And so for decades after, other European explorers who moved through the area attempted to find out what had happened to Mungo Park. And insofar as they gathered much information, it really confirmed these reports. Now, the expeditions that I focus on are the first major expeditions subsequent to Mungo Park's death that attempted to follow up on his journey and learn more about what had happened to him, but also fulfill his mission.
Well, can we talk a little more about that mission then? What exactly were these dual missions expecting to find? What were the theories that were driving these people?
At the beginning of the 19th century, there were multiple theories about where the Niger River went. And at this point, this was seen as, along with the Nile, one of the two major rivers of Africa. One of the theories held that it flowed eastward and flowed into a great lake in the Sahara. Another was that it flowed actually all the way to the Nile River and became part of the Nile's waters. A third theory held, and this was one proposed by a German cartographer, was that it flowed south and emptied into the Gulf of Guinea, which of course proved to be the truth, but was discounted more widely. And a fourth theory, and this was one that Mungo Park himself embraced before he set out on his second expedition, was that the Niger River eventually made its way to what was known as the Congo River, and that the outlet of the Congo River was the outlet of the Niger, that they were in effect the same river. And so the expeditions that were launched immediately after the Napoleonic Wars in 1816 were intending to either confirm or refute this theory. So there were two expeditions, and they were organized as a pair, basically. The first expedition, or one of the expeditions, was an army expedition consisting of about 100 soldiers and auxiliary personnel that was to set off from the Senegambian coast, following much the same route that Mungo Park had himself taken, with the aim of reaching the headwaters of the Nile, building some vessels, sailing down the Niger, and eventually figuring out where it went. The second expedition was a naval expedition consisting of two boats and about 50 sailors and marines. And its objective or mission was to go up the Congo River and follow it as best they could to its source. Now, if Mungo Park was right, the two expeditions might meet actually in the middle of Africa. And that was, of course, the hope. Needless to say, things didn't turn out that way.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Right. Well, I think listeners who know a little bit about African geography now might be shaking their heads a little bit. But, you know, these expeditions are formed. Can you take us a bit into how they're formed? Who are they recruiting to go into the interior in these expeditions?
The Niger expedition is, in many respects, the most interesting in terms of its formation, because it had to be, in their view, a military expedition, well armed. In fact, they included several cannons as part of the expedition. They didn't want to encounter the kind of resistance that Mungo Park had received. But what soldiers could they recruit to carry out this mission? Essentially, they had two options available to them. And because there was a debate about the merits of each of those options, they split the difference and did about half of each. So about half of the soldiers were white convict soldiers. They were members of what was called the Royal African Corps, which sounds more grand than it in fact was. It had been formed a decade or two earlier. Its soldiers were stationed entirely in West Africa, which was known to be a deadly environment. And they were men who had committed crimes of various sorts and were basically lifers with no chance of escape from their situation. The other option in terms of recruits were what were called recaptives. These were Africans who had been taken from slave vessels by British naval patrols along the coast of West Africa after the British had abolished the slave trade. They were deposited in Sierra Leone and then taken as soldiers for British use in West Africa. They too really had very little choice in their service. So both the white and the black soldiers were in effect unfree laborers, but they had different characteristics and different strengths and weaknesses. And that's one of the reasons why authorities decided that they would take some of each. So the black soldiers, for example, they were in many ways regarded as very good soldiers, but there was a fear that if they were brought into the interior, which was the aim of the expedition, they might return to territory they had come from or they had been captured and go AWOL, that's return to their homes. The white soldiers, on the other hand, were in many respects very difficult to control. Many of them were alcoholics. They presented distinct challenges of their own. And so the idea of the authorities who organized the expedition was basically to use some white soldiers and some black soldiers, and each they hoped would keep the other under control. It didn't work out that way.
I think that's really, really great context to have. And I'm sure we're going to pick up a bit more on how those groups are treated differently and regarded differently as we go into the expeditions. I just wanted to return to a point you just made about Britain's stance on slavery at this time and Britain's activity in this area, what it means for their reception when they're going into some of these communities and places.
So 1807, Britain abolishes the slave trade and initiates a naval blockade that attempts to intercept other countries' naval vessels, although that becomes more complicated once the Napoleonic Wars come to an end. In any case, that creates, as you might expect, a certain degree of hostility from European slave traders, but also from the many Africans that are engaged in this slave trade. So in the case of the Niger expedition, for example, they're moving through territory that is organized into a series of what are basically warrior states, each of which are preying upon the other to capture slaves and market them along the coast. And so there's some innate suspicion on the part of the rulers of these states towards British intentions, partly because of what they know about the British effort to limit the slave trade, but also because these states are hostile with one another and British desires to move through these territories creates you know, complications and suspicions that the British may be aiding one state against another and the like, particularly given the fact that the British are bringing with them large amounts of arms and are quite willing to sell and gift those arms and gunpowder to states along the way. So there's that issue. I should say in the case of the Congo expedition, it plays out similarly, but in some respects with an interesting variation. There, the major state that they interact with is a trading state about 50 miles up the Congo River called Boma, which is engaged in very actively in the slave trade. And when the British arrive, there's intense suspicion of British intentions. And the British are only able to persuade the Boma authorities to allow them to continue to go upriver by insisting, no, no, we don't have anything to do with efforts to block the slave trade. You continue with what you're doing. We have this other aim in mind. A more particular and interesting dimension of this that really changes the views of the Boma authorities and makes them willing to allow the vessels to go further up the river is the fact that they bring along a African interpreter, a young man who had himself been enslaved from Boma in a very sort of problematic way. I mean, it's all problematic, but this young man, Som Simmons, had been handed over to a slave trader by a prince of Boma, one of the authorities in the state, to take him, this young man's, to Liverpool for an education. And this was what a number of coastal slave traders were in fact doing because they saw the benefits of having their young sons gain greater knowledge and familiarity with English culture, English language, and the like. This slave trader, however, didn't do that. He actually took the young man to the West Indies, sold him as a slave. Eventually, Som Simmons was able to escape, made his way to England, where he came to the attention of the party preparing the expedition, returned to Boma, where he was the prodigal son returned, and really transformed the views of the Boma authorities about the British and what they were doing.
I'm so glad you went into Som Simmons' story a bit there, because it's a really fascinating element of your book and of that Congo expedition. And something I'd like to pick up on is, or continue on, is the impact of the African people and communities more broadly who interacted with these expeditions. If I can quote you, you write, "Whether they cooperated with explorers or obstructed their ambitions, or each in turn, Africans played a critical role in determining the results of their missions." Can we go into this, and how do we know about these interactions, and from what perspective?
Well, that's a critical question, isn't it? So every historian is limited by the sources of evidence available to him or her. And in my case, that source material consists almost entirely of British sources, the journals of the explorers themselves, correspondence with authorities back at home, reports in newspapers, various other things. There are some African sources that one can draw on, and they're helpful, such as that report by the guide who tried to find out what had happened to Mungo Park. But actually, you can get a good deal of insight into the attitudes and intentions of Africans from the explorers' journals themselves, because the explorers understand, perhaps much more than people back at home, that their survival and their success really depends upon the cooperation that they obtain with African peoples and states. And so the journals are often filled with their conversations with these Africans, the rulers of the various states, trying to understand what they're doing, the Africans understand, trying to understand what the Europeans are doing, and vice versa. And although you do have to read in some sense between the lines and take account of the kinds of biases and distortions that exist from that evidence, you can get a surprisingly rich appreciation of the intentions of these African peoples and rulers. And one of the things that I think becomes clear from this evidence is that although much of the popular literature on exploration in Africa tends to focus on the natural challenges that faced explorers, that is, sort of the impact of deadly tropical diseases or the physical challenges of moving through difficult territory. In point of fact, for both of these expeditions, what really proved crucial to their failure was decisions made by Africans themselves. This was especially evident in the case of the Niger expedition, where it managed to make its way only about 150 miles into the interior on its first iteration. It goes through two iterations. When it tries to negotiate with the rulers of a state called Fouta Djallon, which had been friendly with the British before and had, in fact, sent out trade delegations to Sierra Leone. So there was some expectation that the rulers of Fouta Djallon would be amenable to the expedition moving through their territory. But it becomes clear that this isn't the case. And it isn't the case in part because the rulers are fearful of what benefits the British explorers might bring to the states further into the interior, which are hostile to Fouta Djallon, and also because British patrols along the coast have engaged in conflicts with African traders that have ties to Fouta Djallon and created difficulties there. Plus, the head of the expedition is a very clumsy and difficult negotiator who really muddles everything in various ways. So that fails. But then they try it again further up the coast, where they run into the same problem with two other states as they move into the interior. So it's really these states in particular, but also non-state African actors, for example, in the Congo further upriver, who play a critical role in sort of preventing either expedition from moving very far into the interior.
I wonder if we can touch on the leaders of these expeditions, because we haven't really gone into them yet. And I think they're a really interesting part of the story. To ask an obvious question, what experience in Africa do any of them have? How do they approach these different expeditions?
The leader of the Congo expedition, the fascinating character named James Tuckey, he's an Irishman by birth, enters the Navy and serves largely in the Pacific. He spends some time in Australia, mapping the coast of Australia. He becomes inspired by the achievements of Captain Cook. He clearly wants to emulate Captain Cook, be an explorer in that mode. But he's captured by the French and imprisoned for 8.5 years during the Napoleonic Wars. And when he's finally released in 1815, I mean, it looks like his career is largely at an end, but he had spent the intervening years of imprisonment. It was apparently not a particularly onerous form of imprisonment, studying and writing. And he wrote a 4-volume work on the world from a kind of naval perspective. He knew nothing about Africa. He had never been to Africa. And he saw himself, as I said, more in the mode of Captain Cook than the mode of Mungo Park. But he really follows in the footsteps of Mungo Park and, like Mungo Park, ultimately fails in his achievement. The leaders of the Niger expedition, there are several of them. The first one is a man named Petty, John Petty. An officer in the British Army, also had never been to Africa before he's assigned this task. His second in command is a man named Thomas Campbell, a Scotsman, who had served in Ireland for a time and also elsewhere. None of these two men had spent time in Africa. Petty dies before the expedition sets out while it's still on the coast of Africa. Campbell manages to make the first expedition journey, the one that goes to Fouta Djallon, and then takes his forces, retreats to the coast, where he promptly dies. He's then succeeded by Major William Gray, who's an officer in the Royal Africa Corps. Now, he has been in Africa for about 8-10 years. So he has experience, he has knowledge, and one of the decisions that's made by the man who eventually sort of decides to revive the expedition and put him in command, one of the reasons he selects William Gray is simply the fact that he's a survivor. He's withstood the climate, withstood the diseases, knows the environment, has some local knowledge. It doesn't help him a lot because he runs into the same sorts of political problems in terms of gaining permission from African states to move further into the interior. But it does mean that after several years in the interior, in this futile attempt to break through these barriers and reach the headwaters of the Niger River, he manages to make it back to the coast and survive. And in fact, then goes on, abandons his commission, takes retirement, and moves to Van Diemen's Land, or Australia.
So the fates of a number of these commanders are obviously very telling of the what happens to the wider expeditions. Can I ask, do you think there were any lessons learned that were useful, or do you think they were ignored? Is there somewhere in between?
Well, the primary lesson I think that the British drew from these two expeditions was that sending large parties into the interior was a mistake, that it was seen as a threat by the African communities that they passed through. They also placed an enormous burden on local communities in terms of their need for food and water and shelter and the like. So there were real reasons why these big expeditions were a challenge. So the main lesson that came from this was that, you know, we should send smaller parties. You know, one or two men with, you know, an accompaniment of maybe a half a dozen other individuals. And that approach, in some sense, did have greater success. And in fact, it led eventually to the discovery of the outlet of the Niger River and led to other successes as well. But for the most part, what I think the British failed to learn from this was that they needed to accommodate and cooperate with African states and authorities much more than they had a tendency to do. Now, if it's a small party, they really are very dependent upon Africans and generally aren't seen as a threat. So that's helpful. But no, I don't think they learn a lot from the expeditions.
So there are clearly some very significant human factors at play here with both of the missions' disastrous consequences, but there are also a lot of other factors facing them. Can you take us into some of the calamities that befell these expeditions?
The Niger expedition is, in many respects, a typical army caravan. It has 100 men. They need to carry a vast amount of supplies, gifts, ammunition, other things with them. Well, the soldiers themselves are not going to be carrying all of this. They need pack animals. And so they bring in donkeys, horses, oxen, and camels to carry this mass of supplies up into the interior until they get to the Niger River, which they never come close to getting to, by the way. And these animals, for the most part, are not indigenous to this region, and they start to die off very quickly. They die off from various diseases, probably rinderpest, maybe sleeping sickness. They die off from poisonous plants, from predators like lions. Even African bees attack them and kill some of them. The significance of this is that the whole expedition's logistics depend upon these pack animals. And once they disappear, once they die off, the expedition basically grinds to a halt. And that, in fact, ties us into the impact and the influence of these African authorities. The explorers need someone to help them move their supplies, although they're dumping all sorts of material, including their two cannons, which they bury along the way. They need African porters or carriers. But they can't get those porters without the permission of the rulers of these territories. And so they're effectively under the control of those rulers, who provide some assistance, move them a little further down the road, then cut it off and repeat this process to the point where the expedition sort of grinds completely to a halt. The Congo expedition has a different set of challenges. So the cataracts that blocked access to the upper portions of the Congo River are a series of, you know, sort of rapids, waterfalls, rapids that prevent any kind of navigation from the mouth of the Congo River up into the interior. It's just not possible. And in fact, once the river is in fact explored by a European in the late 19th century, that is Stanley, Henry Morton Stanley, he comes from the opposite end. He goes downriver from the east and manages to run a few of these cataracts or rapids, but for the most part, march around them. Although they knew that there was a cataract that they had to bypass further upriver, about 150 miles upriver, they didn't realize that it was only the first of a series of dozens of cataracts on the lower reaches of the Congo River. And so the expedition has to march along the edge of the river through the forests to get past the first cataract. Then they manage to get past the second. But by that point, they too rely upon porters. And they've spent so much of their gifts purchasing the labor of these porters that they run out of supplies, they run out of gifts, and they realize they can't go any further. In addition, of course, they also start to get sick. And what happens in the case of the Congo expedition is that eventually about half of the members of the expedition die probably of yellow fever in short order.
So both of these expeditions are stymied in similar but obviously very varied ways. There are clearly lessons that have failed to be learned. How was the perception back in Britain of these disastrous expeditions shaped and controlled in their aftermath?
Yeah, keep in mind that information is hard to come by, right? And much of that information is controlled by authorities back in Britain. So, for example, the expedition leaders are expected to write a daily journal, actually produce it, in the case of the Congo expedition, in triplicate, which was a practice common to naval expeditions, and then supply those reports back to authorities at home. So from the start, the authorities back at home had real control over what sort of information was disseminated. What happens in the case of the Congo expedition, once it retreats, it sails actually to the coast of Brazil. That's the easiest, given the trade winds, the easiest place first to arrive, where they try to resupply and regroup before they sail back to England. So information begins to filter back home from Brazil about what had happened to the expedition. That information is largely controlled in particular by John Barrow, who is the Second Secretary of the Admiralty and essentially the great impresario of exploration, British exploration, from, well, through the early 19th century. And he also is someone who writes extensively about exploration for journals and has ties to the press. And so he begins to circulate information about the failure of the expedition, but gives a particular slant on it. In effect, argues that the reason the expedition failed was not so much because of disease, not because of factors that no one could control, but because of what he describes as the excessive zeal of the commanders of the expedition. They were so determined, in his view, to succeed that they drove themselves beyond the limits of endurance. And this is an argument that gets picked up disseminated around in the press, and is also applied then when knowledge of the failure of the Niger expedition begins to make its way back into Britain. There, too, the theme that dominates in the press discussion of these expeditions is that it's due to the zeal of the explorers, their failure to sort of control their determination to success. Now, I should say, there is some other information that begins to circulate, or there's an attempt for information to circulate. So, for example, in the case of the Congo expedition, Barrow gets word that some other publisher is going to publish a journal about the expedition from one of the members of the party. Now, he had control of the journals of the commander and the head of the scientific mission for this expedition, and he was preparing them for publication with a particular publisher. So he's shocked by this word that there's another journal out there that may, in fact, give a different view of what happened in the expedition. And he does his damnedest, basically, to figure out where did this come from, how was it possible, and to stop it. And he eventually does. He finds out that the purser had kept a journal, unbeknownst to him. The purser had died, but it had been returned with the rest of his effects to the purser's widow. And the widow had evidently agreed to allow it to be published. Barrow calls her into his office and clearly threatens her. And that journal disappears from view. We still don't know what has happened to it.
So this narrative, Barrow's narrative, and if that of a few others gets put out there, it obviously shapes perception of these expeditions hugely. I wanted to ask about the impact of these two now forgotten expeditions in better understanding Britain's intentions towards Africa that come in the following decades.
I think there's a tendency to assume that because these expeditions have largely been written out of the narratives of African exploration, that they had no importance. But I think they have importance in several respects. First of all, one of the things they demonstrate is that the British government was far more active in early 19th century African exploration than we typically assume, that the British government was determined to project its influence and power into the interior of Africa and really sort of spent enormous resources to do so. These two expeditions were extraordinarily costly and incredibly ambitious. And they speak to the determination of the British state to make an impact in the interior of Africa in the age of anti-slavery. So that's one of the things that I think these two expeditions reveal that is perhaps a bit at odds with conventional narratives. A second we've spoken about a bit already, and that is that although many conventional narratives tend to focus upon the natural environment as the principal threat and challenge to European explorers in Africa, in point of fact, what these expeditions demonstrate, and it's reproduced in many of those that follow, is that it's African peoples, and particularly the rulers of large African states, which decide whether these expeditions are going to succeed in their missions or not. And so in that respect, the failure of these two expeditions is indicative of something that is repeated time and again. And that speaks to the third way in which these expeditions, I think, are revealing. We tend to think of exploration as this triumph of the will by explorers against terrible odds. But in fact, most expeditions are failures. And many of them are dreadful failures, like the two that I examine in the book. And if you look at the story of British exploration across the course of the 19th century, I think you find that failure is a far more common feature of that story than success.
That was Dane Kennedy. Mungo Park's Ghost, The Haunted Hubris of British Explorers in 19th Century Africa, is published by Cambridge University Press and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.